action for a war that had been planned for years by the US.
The move by Rai to host Zelensky has inflamed the debate on the war in Ukraine in Italy, a country where support for Kiev is more divided than elsewhere in Europe. Since the start of the conflict, surveys in Italy have showed that more than half of the Italians are against supplying Kiev with more weapons.
Many accuse Rai of providing information which is not impartial because the National Broadcaster's Board of Directors is directly linked to the government and the parliamentary majority. As a matter of fact, following a 2015 reform, 6 out of 7 Rai board directors are elected by the 2 houses of parliament and the government.
Chiaramente la Rai.
Italy's state broadcaster is now more than ever in the hands of the politicians. Rai and the government want Zelensky to appear on the television of millions of Italians to make them believe that this Ukraine war is a good war and that sending weapons to Kiev is a good thing.
Italy's Prime Minister Meloni has repeatedly said that supporting Ukraine is the best way to reach a possible negotiated settlement with Moscow and that Rome aims to be a lead player in that regard and in Ukraine's reconstruction. Max Civili, Rome.
The National Media Association in Lebanon held a gathering in the capital Beirut to show solidarity with the Syrian people who continue to suffer because of the U.S. sanctions imposed under the so-called Caesar Act. The journalists, media figures, politicians and representatives of the Resistance Front noted that Syria stood with the resistance groups when the world had abandoned Palestine and Lebanon, and that now is the time to stand with Syria.
From Beirut, the National Media Association announces the Beirut Declaration and calls on the Arab and Islamic people and the free people in the world to work on confronting oppression and stopping the wars of sanctions and famine, which are against basic human rights.
The U.S. State Department has claimed that the sanctions do not target humanitarian aid, but Monday's earthquake has proven the opposite.
It's a mere maneuver by the United States just to confront this wave of indictment to the United States, and it's a way for them to reimpose the sanctions in order to achieve their geopolitical agenda. I believe that we need to keep pressuring the United States, exerting pressure, moral and material pressure, in order to lift the sanctions of Syria.
Over 3,000 people have so far died as a result of the catastrophic earthquake in Syria, as rescue teams continue to search for survivors under the rubble of the buildings, which have been completely leveled to the ground. In addition to rescue efforts, the Syrian people are in dire need of essentials like medicine and fuel, which have not been allowed to enter Syria because of the Western sanctions.
They cannot still like turning around sending humanitarian aids to Syria through NGOs or others. It should be through the governments of Syria. After all, the government is doing all the necessary job to help people and to take them to hospitals or to make shelters or so.
On February 6th, the 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck Turkey and Syria, killing thousands in the two countries. While countries like Iran and Russia have sent aid to Syria, the amount of humanitarian assistance that reached the Arab country is still very little compared to the international aid sent to Turkey.
At least 5 rescue teams from Lebanon headed directly to Syria to provide all the assistance they can of the rescue efforts, yet many are saying the aid that many are providing is not enough. Participants here today stressed that the U.S. and its Western allies need to lift the unjust sanctions against Syria and the Syrian people. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Once again, the International Fajr Film Festival brought together filmmakers and movie critics from across the world, as well as movie lovers, this time for its 41st edition. A festival made even more special, considering that the international section was reintegrated into the national festival after 6 years of holding separate events.
This year, 26 feature-length movies from 25 countries were competing in the international section. For many of them, this is their regional premiere. The movie market also allows producers and filmmakers to get to know each other and negotiate further cooperation.
I've attended the festival on behalf of the Ministry of Culture of Russia, and based on what I've seen in the past 10 days, I believe that there is a great potential for joint production.
And for those keeping an eye on the festival, the award ceremony was what they've been waiting for.
Jaishan Kalariar, the director of this movie.
Our jury made a slight change to the order. You'll know that it's initially for best director, but we decided that instead we would like very much to give it to a new and promising filmmaker who's both written and directed his film. So congratulations to him.
I would like to dedicate this award for the three filmmakers whom I admire, Mr. Abbas Kiarostami, Asghar Faradi, and Majid Majidi.
I'm an engineer by profession, but when I got a lot of free time, I used to watch a lot of cinema. And when I watched Iranian films, they had a great influence in my style. And three filmmakers, specific, Abbas Kiarostami, Asghar Faradi, and Majid Majidi have influenced my filmmaking style a lot. And my film is a byproduct of their films.
In the national section, 24 movies were picked out of 87 entries to compete for the top award. What made the national section stand out this year was a whole new generation of first-time directors from different provinces across the country.
Taking part in a festival is what motivates most of us working in the business, and I can tell you for sure that the competition was really tough this year with young up-and-coming directors who participated.
As far as I know, there were lots of young directors taking part this year, so I can tell you for sure that this wasn't an easy competition.
With all of its glitz and glamour and prestige, the 41st Fajr International Film Festival has come to an end. But this time, promising new horizons for first-time directors. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Perhaps anticipating a hero's welcome, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky traveled to the Belgian capital on Thursday with a list of demands. He has asked for long-range missiles and warplanes to use against Russian forces. He also wants Kiev to be granted EU membership without delay.
Of course, membership, and that's why, of course, we need it this year. And this year, Charles, when I say this year, I mean this year.
Those with intimate knowledge of how the EU works believe it is a pipe dream.
Turkey will not be pleased because they are already waiting since 2005 in formal discussions. Then we have the Western Balkans. Also there, something is boiling in Bosnia and Serbia. So these countries, they will say, wait a minute, what about us? And for sure, there are definitely member states who will block this.
EU leaders concluded their latest summit on Friday. The most up-to-date cost of supporting Ukraine was revealed. And it's eye-watering.
67 billion of support we have mobilized in the last 12 months, from budget support to fast recovery, from energy supply to military capabilities, from humanitarian aid to refugee support. And we must do more.
A number of EU lawmakers encourage solidarity with Ukraine, but also want support for the bloc's own hard-pressed citizens.
Solidarity with our most vulnerable, who struggle to put food on the table or heat the home, or those in difficulty maintaining a roof over their heads.
While Zelensky was touring Europe, who was running the show back in Kiev? US and NATO commanders? The Kremlin has warned Western powers not to become too involved in the conflict. There's no doubt EU citizens have a great deal of sympathy and empathy for the people of Ukraine. But there's growing concern about the level of pressure, some might call it provocation, being exerted on Russia by Western leaders. Many are nervously asking, when might Putin say, enough is enough? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In February 1951, with the Korean War raging, the South Korean army killed more than 700 fellow South Koreans, suspected communist sympathizers. The victims of the Gochang massacre were found to be innocent civilians. Most of them were women and children. Jung Young-ju was 4 years old when much of his family was killed.
The only people around here then were very young and very old, living simple lives with no role in politics. But the soldiers rounded them up and killed them. Those young children, the elderly South Korean women, what's wrong with them? When I think about it now, I cry and can't sleep.
Since the 1990s, memorials and a museum have been established. But for decades, the massacre was suppressed by South Korea's military dictatorships and previous monuments destroyed. Early local investigators faced state-sponsored violence in prison. Survivors now seek compensation.
If the restoration of honor is to be real, I think compensation for our bereaved family must be completed.
South Korea's Supreme Court last December ruled in favor of the victims of the Gochang massacre, suggesting the state may be responsible for the killings. Lee Sung-yul is lobbying the National Assembly to pass a law outlining redress.
The court found that the victims were killed by the armed forces, so the Gochang massacre should be compensated even more than other similar incidents in South Korea. That was the ruling of the Supreme Court at the end of last year. The Gochang massacre must be compensated by the state.
The Gochang massacre represents just one episode of South Korea's often painful and forgotten past. But the divisions laid bare here remain, as survivors seek compensation and understanding from their nation. Frank Smith, Gochang, South Korea.
A ceremony in the Afghan capital Kabul has marked the 44th anniversary of Iran's Islamic Revolution, bringing together officials from Afghanistan's Taliban ruling system as well as foreign diplomats representing various countries. In the event, Shir Mohammad Abbas Stanekzai, the deputy foreign minister of Afghanistan, stressed that Iran's 1979 revolution was an Islamic and popular movement.
Our neighbor and friend Iran today celebrates a movement that 44 years ago led to the foundation of an Islamic government in Iran under the leadership of late Imam Khomeini. A positive point of this revolution is that it achieved victory in a short period.
The Islamic Revolution of Iran also had an impact on other nations, especially those that had been oppressed, and inspired them to stand against tyranny.
Following the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the issue of imperialism turned into world arrogance, oppression, and justice. This Islamic viewpoint didn't remain limited to Islamic countries. Even today, you see movements against world arrogance in Latin America. It was right after the Islamic Revolution that plots of the adversaries started to fail. I can refer to the U.S. presence in Afghanistan and Iraq that happened to be big failures for the U.S.
Shortly after Iran's Islamic Revolution, Afghanistan was also invaded by the Soviet Union. In those years, the Iranian Revolution inspired people here to stand against the invaders.
Afghanistan might be the country that was inspired the most by the revolution, especially in the early years following its victory. The fight against the Soviet forces in Afghanistan became more serious at that time, and it eventually led to the eviction of the Soviet Union from Afghanistan.
44 years after the Islamic Revolution of Iran, more and more countries commemorate their revolution and this spirit of standing against tyranny. The Islamic Revolution of Iran 44 years ago was the beginning of a trend that in Afghanistan inspired people to expel then-Soviet Union. Dullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
The National Media Association in Lebanon held a gathering in the capital, Beirut, to show solidarity with the Syrian people who continue to suffer because of the U.S. sanctions imposed under the so-called Caesar Act. The journalists, media figures, politicians, and representatives of the resistance front noted that Syria stood with the resistance groups when the world had abandoned Palestine and Lebanon, and that now is the time to stand with Syria.
From Beirut, the National Media Association
announces the Beirut Declaration and calls on the Arab and Islamic people and the free people in the world to work on confronting oppression and stopping the wars of sanctions and famine, which are against basic human rights.
The U.S. State Department has claimed that the sanctions do not target humanitarian aid, but Monday's earthquake has proven the opposite.
It's a mere maneuver by the United States just to confront this wave of indictment to the United States, and it's a way for them to reimpose the sanctions in order to achieve their geopolitical agenda. I believe that we need to keep pressuring the United States, exerting pressure, moral and material pressure, in order to lift the sanctions of Syria.
Over 3,000 people have so far died as a result of the catastrophic earthquake in Syria, as rescue teams continue to search for survivors under the rubble of the buildings, which have been completely leveled to the ground. In addition to rescue efforts, the Syrian people are in dire need of essentials like medicine and fuel, which have not been allowed to enter Syria because of the Western sanctions.
They cannot still like turning around sending humanitarian aids to Syria through NGOs or others. It should be through the governments of Syria. After all, the government is doing all the necessary job to help people and to take them to hospitals or to make shelters or so.
On February 6th, the 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck Turkey and Syria, killing thousands in the two countries. While countries like Iran and Russia have sent aid to Syria, the amount of humanitarian assistance that reached the Arab country is still very little compared to the international aid sent to Turkey.
At least five rescue teams from Lebanon headed directly to Syria to provide all the assistance they can of the rescue efforts, yet many are saying the aid that many are providing is not enough. Participants here today stressed that the U.S. and its Western allies need to lift the unjust sanctions against Syria and the Syrian people. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
More than 1,700 guests attended the National Day reception in the center of Moscow, hosted by the Iranian embassy to mark the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. The reception was attended by top Russian dignitaries, as well as military figures and members of the civil society. Non-Russian diplomats could also be seen at the event.
Basing on objective analysis, I am absolutely sure that now our Russian people with Iranian people should fight together against the great enemy, our common enemy, understanding together each other better, better and better, as well on the spiritual level.
The prominent philosopher says he predicted that modern Iran and Russia would grow closer years ago. They share the same values, interests, and both belong to the ancient Eurasian civilization. They also seek to bring an end to years of Western dominance and oppression across the globe.
Iran is truly one of a kind in this world. It is one of the most ancient civilizations, and it continues to live up to that legacy. Despite heavy sanctions and pressure, they have made astonishing achievements in the past four decades. People are high-spirited. Iranians yearn for development. I'm very glad that the relations between Iran and Russia are flourishing. Together we can solve many problems in West Asia and around the world.
According to Russian Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak, in the last year alone, trade with Iran and Russia has reached $5 billion. The position of the two countries is in tune with a number of international agendas. The two nations oppose the model of a unipolar device and will do everything to defend their sovereignty.
Iran is an example of a harmonious combination of the principles of religion, human rights, and national interests. We maintain a high intensity of political and economic dialogue between our countries. Russian-Iranian cooperation is reaching a qualitatively new strategic level, despite the illegal pressure of unfriendly countries.
The guests of the reception all believed in one thing. The stability of Iran's Islamic Revolution is due to the unquestioning support of people. Iranians are defending their revolution despite constant propaganda, as well as huge funds to overthrow its results.
The anniversary of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution is commemorated in Russia every year. As the two countries continue to expand ties, Russian political elite pay their respect to Iran. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
In the limelight.
The U.S. experienced more than 600 mass shootings in 2022, nearly double the number recorded 4 years ago when there were 336. This was reported by the Washington-based Gun Violence Archive. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International Roads, Americans not only kill other people by the millions, at least 32 million have been killed since 2001. They also kill their own by the tens of thousands. In 2022, the nonprofit group Gun Violence Archive recorded 43,789 deaths in 2022 related to gun violence in the U.S. Even children are not spared, as the latest figures released by Gun Violence Archive, GVA, on December 27, 2022 showed. At least 6,032 children, 17 years or younger, have been killed or injured in 2022 so far, according to GVA data. The GVA figures for 2022 showed that 306 children, 11 years of age and younger, died by gunfire. Another 668 were injured. The figure for age bracket 12 to 17 provide an even more horrifying picture. 1,325 deaths and 3,732 injuries due to gunfire. This is the highest number of gun-related casualties since the GVA started keeping a record in 2014. The 2022 figures mark a notable increase in number of deaths and injuries since last year, when 5,708 casualties were recorded across the U.S. So far, there have been 609 mass shootings in the U.S. up to November 2022, according to GVA figures. Will these figures reach more than that number by the end of the year 2023? To equal the highest number of shootings recorded in the U.S., schools across the U.S. have also been targeted. On May 24, 2022, one of the most horrific school mass shootings occurred at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. Salvador Ramos, 18, entered the school and barricaded himself in a classroom where he shot and killed 19 students aged 7 to 10 and two teachers. Before arriving at the school for his shooting spree, Ramos had also shot his grandmother. She was admitted to hospital in critical condition where she died. Ramos was shot and killed by U.S. Border Patrol agents and UCISD officers after they breached the classroom. Families of the victims of Uvalde school shooting have since launched a class action lawsuit against local and state police, the city, and other school and law enforcement officials seeking $27 billion due to delays in confronting the attacker, court documents show. The lawsuit filed in Austin, Texas, states that law enforcement officials failed to follow active attacker protocol when they waited for 77 minutes before confronting the attacker inside a fourth grade classroom. While the most recent school mass shooting of all was not the most horrific, it was preceded by such other school shootings at those as Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut on December 14, 2012, and the Virginia Tech shooting in Blacksburg, Virginia of April 16, 2007. At a Sandy Hook Elementary School, 20-year-old Adam Lentz arrived with four guns. He entered a first grade class where he shot and killed 20 children aged 6 and 7, along with six adults, including four teachers, the principal, and the school psychologist. Two other people were injured. He also shot himself before the police arrived. In the Virginia Tech shooting, 23-year-old student Song Hoi Cho killed 32 students and faculty members in two separate attacks on campus. He also injured 17 others before committing suicide. On April 20th, 1999, a school shooting and attempting bombing occurred at Columbine High School in Columbine, Colorado, that came to set an example for mass shootings at schools across the U.S. The perpetrators were two 12th grade students, Eric David Harris and Dylan Bennett Klebold. They murdered 12 students and one teacher before they committed suicide. It was the deadliest high school shooting in U.S. history at the time. Texas, Florida, and California have also recorded multiple school shootings. China Daily also reported in 2022 the U.S. again led the world in gun-related deaths, more than 20,900, including homicides and suicide, Gun Violence Archive says. And the U.S. has the highest number of guns per capita at more than 400 million weapons, meaning there is more than one gun for every man, woman, and child. Richard Burke, a professor emeritus of criminology and statistics at the University of Pennsylvania, told the Washington Post, "Many other countries have disadvantaged folks who are angry and alienated. But guns aren't there." Mass shootings in the U.S. have followed a predictable and superficial script, with a few exceptions. They produce calls for greater gun controls, including banning automatic weapons. Gun advocates defend the right to bear arms. There are instant monuments to victims, and there are candlelight vigils. The media profiles the victims and the shooter. The shooter's Facebook page or blog will be found, and perhaps a note giving a hint of why the shooting happens. And there are heartfelt comments from politicians from the local level to the White House. China Daily added, with few exceptions, most of the shootings fade from the national conversation, but the scenario unfolds again when the new one occurs. There are those who offer a radical solution: arm good guys to take on bad guys, and that is what is happening in the U.S. The increase in the number of public shootings involving guns is causing people to arm themselves out of fear. Gun sales peak after mass shootings, partly for fear of victimization and partly for fear of increased regulation. They rose after school shootings amid coronavirus shutdowns, racial justice protests, the presidential election in 2020, and after the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. There is deadly gun violence in the U.S. every day, and mass shootings, especially in schools, draw much more attention. However, those shootings represent a fraction of gun violence overall, said Gillian Peterson, an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hemline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, and co-founder of the Violence Project, which studies mass killers. Mass shootings, Peterson told the Post, account for fewer than 1% of all people killed by firearms. They are very rare still, even though they're increasing. Mass shootings by design are meant to go viral, Peterson said. The goal of them is fame, notoriety. Public mass shootings have a psychological impact on people, instilling fear of going to movies or a grocery store, she said. While mass shootings draw attention, most gun deaths in the U.S. are either suicides or homicides, according to federal figures, with accidental or unterminated gun deaths, representing a small fraction of the overall share. Almost 60% of gun deaths each year are suicides, the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention says.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. 2022 was the deadliest year for Palestinians on the West Bank. Since the United Nations started keeping records in 2005, 146 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank last year. But already this year, the Zionist entity seems to be on its way to breaking that record. We're only halfway through the second month of 2023, and already Israel has killed around 50 Palestinians in the West Bank. Israel has also regularly bombed Gaza, and now with a right-wing cabinet in place, the situation is only expected to get worse. Israel's far-right cabinet has approved the legislation of 9 settler outposts in the occupied West Bank. All settlements are illegal, according to international law, but who pays attention to international law in this occupied land? Well, I'd like to start this spotlight off, and I'd like to welcome my guests to the program.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
appreciate both of you being with me here on the Spotlight, starting it off in Gaza City. And Mr. Mohammed Abu Saada, why do you think we're seeing an exacerbation in the violence committed by Israeli forces against the Palestinians now?
Many thanks for having me in your program.
Thank you for coming.
Israel has been occupying Palestinian land for over half a century now. It's been 55 years of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory, West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. And according to the Israeli human rights group, B'Tselem, which is an Israeli human rights group, has classified Israel as an apartheid and occupation regime, which is systematically killing the Palestinians. As you just mentioned, around 50 Palestinians have been killed, shot killed by Israel since the beginning of this year, 2023. Over the year 2022, more than 230 Palestinians were killed by Israel in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. And let me also add that since the beginning of this year, Israel has demolished 34 homes or housing units that belong to the Palestinians, justifying that the Palestinians have no permit for those buildings. Israel has systematically gone after the Palestinians in a way that has been described by many UN experts as a collective punishment against more than 5 million people who live in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. And unfortunately, Israel has so far succeeded from any international sanctions or any international punishments for its violation of international law and its violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which very much describe all of Israeli activities in the Palestinian territories as illegal and must stop immediately.
Okay, let me get our other guests in. And Feras, good to see you. How much of what we're seeing has to do with the right-wing Israeli government in place at this time, and how much does it have to do simply with the occupied entity that it is?
Yes, everybody knows that Israel is an illegitimate regime from its foundation. It's a colonial project. It was, installed and planted in West Asia that they call Middle East to, have a base to support the colonial powers, such as the British, the French, and the Americans. And this Israeli regime right now really represents, the peak of how criminal and how colonial of an entity this is. We can see that they have no mercy towards the Palestinians, no respect for international law. They feel like there's no accountability in any way, because there's truly there is no accountability. The United Nations is a tool now being used to support certain agendas and to help some criminal regimes to get away with their crimes. There's no punishment. How many times has the Israeli regime breached international law? How many times have they violated the human rights and killed innocent people, such as Shireen Abu Akla not too long ago, an iconic, well-known journalist? She was shot bluntly. She had an American citizen as well, and they didn't do nothing about it. They haven't, there's no investigation. There's no, real punishment against the Israeli regime. So the Israeli regime really feels they have a green light to commit any crime without any type of accountability. Mm-hmm. And this is the problem that we're having, is the United Nations that people trust and feel like this is a system that's supposed to support the world peace and hold people, accountable for committing crimes. So the criminals are actually supported by the United Nations. And the Israeli regime today with Netanyahu and all these right-wing extremist radicals really shows what this system has became and what the system's roots were.
Okay.
I mean, this is truly, truly a criminal state from the beginning and to the end.
All right, turning back to Gaza. Mohammed, with the approval of more illegal occupation on the West Bank, do you think that we will see more aggressive measures taken by Palestinians as a reaction?
Well, that is definitely a very good question. Let me say that Israeli settlement in the Palestinian territories, or Israeli illegal settlement in the Palestinian territories, has not started as a response to Palestinian attacks or a response to Palestinian resistance to the Israeli occupation. Israel is just trying to, in a way, trying to legitimize its illegal activities in the Palestinian territories by describing these activities as in retaliation for Palestinian attacks against Israelis. Since 1967, Israel has planted more than 800,000 Israeli Jewish settlers in the West Bank and the city of Al-Quds. Just yesterday, the Israeli right-wing government has decided to legalize 9 illegal outposts, which has been implanted by extremist Israeli settlers on the hills of the West Bank. And let me say that this Israeli latest decision to legalize these illegal outposts is a slap on the face for the American administration, which has been trying lately by sending many of its top diplomats to the region to try to convince the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his government to stop Israeli settlement expansion in the Palestinian territories.
Let me just jump in here, Mohammed. Let me just jump in here with what you said. So you really feel that the United States want the Israelis to stop expanding the settlements?
Well, that is a very critical question, to be honest with you. But let me say that on the record, the U.S. administration during the Obama administration did not veto a UN Security Council resolution in December 2016, in the last days of the Obama administration. And that administration did not veto that decision, which, in a way, described Israeli settlement activity in the Palestinian territories as illegal and must be stopped. Now, the current U.S. administration has been repeatedly saying that it's with the two-state solution, it's with the integrity of the Palestinian territory, where the Palestinians can have their own state on the West Bank and East Jerusalem. But unfortunately, the U.S. has failed miserably to stop Israel, or has failed to stop this Israeli settlement activity. Okay. We haven't seen any sanctions by U.S., or we haven't seen any measures by the U.S. to stop Israeli settlement activity in the Palestinian territories. But if you allow me just to go back to the question, we do expect that we will be seeing more and more Palestinian retaliation against Israeli activities, because the Palestinians feel that they are left on their own, that the international community is not holding Israel responsible, mm-hmm. the Arab region is not punishing Israel, and the Palestinians feel that they have to take matters under their own hand by defending themselves against the Israeli apartheid and occupation regime.
All right. Well, Faraz, your take on that. Do you think, as our previous guest just talked about, during the Obama presidency, because they did not veto a certain situation in the UN, that the United States actually wants Israel to stop expanding their settlement activities? Your assessment of that, if Washington really wanted it to do it, do you think that it could make Israel do what it wants?
Yes, we it's very clear that if the U.S. wanted to really punish or stop the Israelis from doing some major crimes, they could. And they have the power to do that, because they have veto in the United Nations and so on. And they have other measures that they can take. But the U.S. is playing games, as usual. You know, sometimes they might veto a certain thing, make it look like they care about Palestinian human rights, because they're ashamed at certain times in front of the world. So they want to make it look like they have some type of respect for human rights and humanity, because they're sometimes under fire and being questioned and things like that. So they kind of want to have something manipulated to be able to present that we did support the Palestinians, we did send some pocket change to the Palestinians to support them, and so on. But this is all a game. They do not care about the human rights in Palestine. They have always supported the Israeli regime, and they're always protecting the Israeli regime, and they're always making sure that the Israeli regime is progressing and growing with all their crimes. And this is very clear in the Zionist lobbies in the U.S., the Zionist lobbies in the West in general, in Canada, and so on. They all work together, and they're all submissive to the interest of controlling the region, and Israel is that base that they have planted there, that evil, cancerous base, you know. But they're surrounded. They're surrounded by the axis of resistance, by the Islamic Republic of Iran and its great work since the Islamic Revolution of Imam al-Khomeini, now that we've just commemorated 44 years. We were celebrating the anniversary. This revolution is what grew this strength and resistance. And the only solution to all these problems is real united resistance against the Israeli occupation.
Okay.
And we're seeing now that the resistance inside Palestine is growing on a heavy level. This young generation is very strong, very determined, and they're learning new tactics how to punish the Israeli regime, since the world is not truly punishing the Israeli regime or the United Nations and all these bodies that we're supposed to trust to do the job. So the Palestinians are going to have to do it themselves with their own hands. And they deserve weapons. They deserve to protect themselves. And this is the right of any nation that's oppressed and under occupation.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right. Well, Mohammed, the right-wing government of Netanyahu is facing increasing dissatisfaction and demonstrations from Israelis themselves. Protesters say the current government is trying to pass legislation to increase its power over the Supreme Court. Your overall assessment on this major discontent inside, and how do you see this possibly affecting the overall Palestinian situation?
Well, the current Israeli right-wing government led by Netanyahu and the right-wing coalition has been facing a very strong opposition in Israel since its establishment for about a month and a half now. Over the past 6 weeks, we have seen the Israeli leftist and center-left opposition protesting in the streets of Tel Aviv and other Israeli major cities like Haifa and Jerusalem. And today there was a big demonstration against the Israeli Knesset, which is overwhelmed by the Israeli right-wing political parties and Israeli religious parties. And the Israeli Knesset is trying to legalize or issue a new law that will reform the Israeli judicial system, which will, in a way, jeopardize the so-called Israeli democracy in the eyes of the Israeli left and center left. Now, definitely the Israeli right-wing government is facing a very tough political opposition inside Israel. And I think this Israeli protest that has been going on weekly in Israel is, in a way, benefiting the Palestinians by showing the ugly face of this current right-wing coalition government, which is opposed not by the Palestinians, it is opposed by its own people, the Israeli left and center left, who are protesting against this government. And I think we might very much see that this Israeli right-wing government will not be able to survive its 4 years term as a result of this Israeli internal opposition.
Well, Faris, on a practically daily basis, we see that the regime in Tel Aviv has either wounded or killed another Palestinian. And this seems to make the Palestinian population more resilient. And on the other side, we've seen more and more Israelis leaving or returning to their native countries or those of their parents. Your take on all of this, and where do you see this entity going in the future?
I think that the more extremist they go, the more violations that they commit, the closer it is to the end of this regime that is crumbling. And hopefully we see more internal problems between the Israeli regime and its supporters and the different factions inside. And this is all good signs, actually. You know, we might, some people might look at it as a sign that we're in fear or we're having more people dying. But these people that die are martyrs. They're people that die for the sake of God, for humanity, for their nation. And it's not a normal nation. We're talking about Palestine is a holy nation for the Muslims, Christians, and Jews. It's a holy land of the prophets. This battle is a divine battle. And I think that the Palestinians have a right to resist, and this is the, honorable for them. And the Palestinians in this era right now, with all the social media, they're getting stronger and stronger, and they're getting more empowered. And let's hope that the more people in the world will always make videos and go out and protest and hold all these Western politicians accountable, unmask them if they're supporting the Israeli regime, especially if they preach and they promote human rights and they speak about, you know, that they care about people and humans and this and that. And then, you know, at the end of the day, they don't care about the Palestinians that have been occupied for 75 years. People are crying for the Ukrainian people, saying that this place is occupied for about a year or so. But what about these Palestinians that have been occupied for 75 years? Do they not deserve respect? Do we not honor that they're martyrs and they're resistance fighters that fight the Israeli occupation, that commits all types of gruesome crimes? They steal people's houses, they demolish houses of the families of the martyrs in front of the eyes of their mothers and their daughters and their children. And their grandmothers and grandfathers have to see these things. They're uprooting their olive trees that they survive on, and this is the way they make their money. All these crimes are going to come to an end. And as the leader of the resistance group, Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, said, that this shows signs that this extremism of the Israeli regime could bring a closer end to the Israeli regime. And we're praying for this. We're praying for the liberation of the Palestinians and freedom, and for the people to live in honor and dignity and respect. And this is what the Palestinians deserve. And we will always support them from everywhere in the world. We cannot call ourselves a human rights defenders or supporters if we don't stand up for the Palestinians.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us. Unfortunately, we're out of time, out of Gaza City. Mohammed Abu Saad, lecturer, Al-Azhar University. Out of Toronto, manager, Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Feroz Najma. And as always, we appreciate you being with us for another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.